King Canute has been badly done by. An exceptionally able monarch, he is made to appear a silly old fool. So for once, let us tell the famous legend correctly. His courtiers extolled King Canute's powers in those grandiose terms which are characteristic of courtiers everywhere. His powers, they indeed told him, were unlimited. It was then that Canute ordered his throne to be carried to the seaside. It was then that he ordered the tides to stand still. Not, however, in order to prove that his powers were indeed unlimited. Quite the contrary, it was in order to demonstrate the foolishness of the courtiers. If the story is so often reversed, to make it appear that Canute really thought that by raising his hand he could stem the tide, this testifies to our difficulty in believing that any ruler could have the good sense to recognise his limitations. Canute deliberately chose an uncontroversial example to make his point. The rise and fall of the tides obey laws of nature, not man-made laws. Only in madness would even the most megalomaniac ruler order the suspension of the laws of gravity. There are other examples of his limitations, no less obvious, which he might have chosen. He might have ordered his courtiers to go to the Mendip Hills in Somerset and bring him back lead for use in his wars. Inevitably, they would have failed. The mines were long since exhausted. Canute would thus have reminded his courtiers of two things. The first, that a government must have resources in order to exert its power, and secondly, that these resources always have bounds. This is a lesson still worth heeding in Australia, where we like to talk of our resources as boundless. We castigate those geographers who draw attention to our limitations, and we seem to imagine that to say of a resource that it will last for 200 years is substantially equivalent to saying that it will last forever. Governments, then, are limited by natural laws and natural resources. Who could doubt as much? I'm exercising one of the philosopher's functions to remind fanatics of the obvious. Let me continue in the same vein. Governments are not omniscient. One of the most important facts about governments is that for all the information and the advice they have at their disposal, they often cannot think up ways of doing what they want to do. They find this very hard to admit. You were elected in order to govern, not to dilly-dally, their supporters say to them. It isn't easy to reply, yes, but we simply don't know what to do. Governments may be tempted to act blindly or ineffectively just in order to look decisive, to expect too much from governments, to ascribe to them a degree of knowledge and wisdom which they neither have nor can be expected to have, is the surest path to cynicism, to disillusionment with the political process. It is when we go beyond such obvious truths, obvious on a moment's reflection, but easily overlooked in the heat of political enthusiasm, that the real disputes begin. Disputes about what governments cannot do, about what they cannot do well, about what they should not do. These are disputes philosophers have waged over the centuries. Ever since, in his Republic, Plato designed what was in his eyes an ideal society in which an elite group of philosopher kings ruled over every aspect of human life, determining who should marry whom, what music should be permitted, how children should be educated, thus anticipating in a startling way the totalitarian societies of our own time. When, as a young student in 1931, I first read Plato's Republic, I could not believe that any real government, as distinct from Plato's ideal government, would act so absurdly as to censor music, although I only needed to look around me to know that governments were only too willing to censor literature. But I had not then realised that there is no limit to the arrogance of governments, their willingness to assume that they know better than we do what is good for us. I live to see both China and the Soviet Union censor music. Not all philosophers have shared Plato's enthusiasm for government control. Indeed, it was a moral philosopher, Adam Smith, who in The Wealth of Nations gave classical expression to the quite contrary view that except in a small range of instances, such as the building of ports and roads, where there was no manageable way of making the user pay, government should entirely withdraw from any attempt to intervene in the economic life of the country. A country's economic life, he argued, was best left to the free operation of markets with their constant adjustments to rapidly changing circumstances. His teachings, revolutionary at a time when government controls over trade were taken for granted, continued to exert a profound influence for about a century after The Wealth of Nations appeared in 1776. In the middle of the 19th century, yet another philosopher, John Stuart Mill, extended Adam Smith's argument against government intervention in economic life to artistic and intellectual enterprise. Governments, he maintained, have no rights to censor opinions, or more generally, to exercise any form of moral guardianship over their citizens. In his later writings, however, Mill began to assign a more positive role to government. That was typical. A renewed enthusiasm for governmental control, at first confined to German thinkers, came to be widespread. Meanwhile, government intervention increased without the benefit of doctrine in response to emergencies in industrial societies. Not so long ago, it looked as if every society, socialist or capitalist, was set in a course in which government would become steadily more powerful, in which our life, our economic life especially, would be ever more regulated, in which governments would set out to protect us against all the ills to which not only the flesh, but the spirit is heir. The very meaning of the word radical changed. To the 18th century radical Tom Paine, writing in that very same remarkable year, 1776, in which Adam Smith published The Wealth of Nations and America declared its independence, the situation was plain. Government is at best a necessary evil, at worst an intolerable burden. Everything good, on Paine's view, comes from society, from human beings pursuing their interests in voluntary contracts or through voluntary organizations, freely cooperating, freely competing. But radicalism, the left, gradually came to be committed to the quite contrary doctrine that all blessings flow from government, that voluntary organizations, socialist parties of course excepted, are at best inefficient, at worst conspiracies against the people. It is hard to believe nowadays that radical French workers once refused the offer of government pensions as a threat to their independence. The meaning of conservatism is now being subjected to a similar change in the contrary direction. Mrs. Thatcher is not a conservative in the traditional sense of that word, any more than socialists are radicals in the traditional sense of radical. Her leading assumption, indeed, is Tom Paine's, that government is at best a necessary evil, at worst an intolerable burden. This assumption is now commonly described, since the older words like radical have changed their meaning, as the libertarian assumption. In its classical form, in contrast, conservatism was paternalistic. It was not at all libertarian. The first welfare state, indeed, was set up in Prussia by that arch-conservative Bismarck in the final decades of the 19th century. Both in England and in Australia, conservative governments have contributed to the rise of government power. The conservative is a staunch defender of private property. So long as it protects private property, he has no objection whatsoever to strong, centralized government. He cares about private enterprise only as a path to property, not in and for itself, as an exercise of human imagination, human ingenuity. Indeed, he often mistrusts enterprise, whether in industry, in art, in technology, or in science, as disruptive, disturbing to the established order of things. Their traditional commitment to private property does not fully explain, then, why such political leaders as Mrs. Thatcher, President Reagan, Mr. Fraser, are sometimes to be heard mouthing libertarian sentiments, demanding small government where their conservative predecessors called for strong government. These political leaders are just one manifestation of a much broader tendency to seek a reduction in the powers of government. There have always been economists, even during the heyday of government planning, who followed Adam Smith in arguing that government should not attempt to take over from free competitive markets in order directly to govern the economic life of the community, since any such attempt was bound to end in failure. But they were largely ignored in a wave of enthusiasm for government direction, whether as full-blooded socialist planning or the intervention espoused by Keynes. Now they have influential followers among the economists, just as philosophers are again espousing the anti-government sentiments of Herbert Spencer and the younger J.S. Mill. Even socialists have been influenced by the renewed mistrust of government. So, in England, Mr. David Owen of the New Social Democratic Party stands for what he calls the radical, democratic, libertarian tradition of decentralized socialism, a really splendid example of the politician's attempt to have it all ways at once. And even the left-wing socialist, Mr. Tony Benn, describes himself as a libertarian socialist and professes himself to be disturbed by the prospect of a managerial authoritarianism, government centralization, which would be even worse than capitalism. As for the young, they will cheer at Cambridge, well, not long ago he would have been howled down, Friedrich von Hayek, proclaiming, as he has done for half a century past, that the welfare state was the road to serfdom. In Australia, the young liberals now attempt to out-Fraser Mr. Fraser, where they once advocated government intervention in the name of welfare. Perhaps all this is nothing more than a momentary interruption in the historical process by which government has gradually swallowed up independent social institutions. After all, the new conservative governments are far from being consistently libertarian. They defend a curious and unstable combination, sometimes entitled neoconservatism, of the old conservatism and resurrected libertarianism. They often, like Mr. Reagan, derive much of their support from such organizations as the so-called moral majority, corresponding to our Festival of Light, who are anything but libertarian in their attitude to personal conduct. American neoconservatism is a strange doctrine indeed. In the economic sphere, on the neoconservative view, anything goes, but personal conduct ought to be rigorously confined by government action. As for business, if it makes libertarian noises from time to time, the next moment it runs to the government for help. Get off my back, but before you go put a cushion beneath my backside, not unfairly describes its attitude. Nevertheless, it would be wrong, I think, to dismiss the revival of libertarianism and its infiltration into both conservative and socialist thinking as no more than a passing fashion. It has its roots in genuine dissatisfactions. The legal historian A.V. Dicey predicted in 1905 that the century to come would witness a growing degree of governmental intervention until in the end it provoked a taxpayer's revolt. That is certainly one thing that has happened, as quite ordinary citizens find themselves paying tax at what was not long ago a millionaire's rate. But so long as there was a conviction that tax money was being well spent, I doubt whether the taxpayers' revolt would have issued in anything more serious than individual cases of grumbling, tax evasion, black marketeering. To take shape as libertarianism, it had to be accompanied by a growing impatience with the multitude of regulations the welfare state engenders, and a widespread feeling that it was not working. The emergence of a phenomenon which had been widely dismissed as impossible, so startling that we had to find a new word for it, stagflation, in which unemployment and inflation run hand in hand, this undermined the view that economic experts now know how to run the economy. The massive expenditure on education and health, so its critics argued, was not bearing fruit in a better educated or a healthier population. Housing schemes issued in urban wildernesses, more crime-ridden than the slums they replaced, social inequalities were not being reduced, discontent was not being assuaged, peace and happiness were as remote as ever. In the United States, ever given to recurrent waves of optimism and despair, this feeling of failure was particularly acute. But it has affected every modern society in some degree. As happened earlier with 19th century libertarianism, the achievements of the welfare state were forgotten. Its defects were underlined. There were still those who argued, of course, that the welfare state failed only insofar as it did not go far enough and could not do so without destroying bourgeois society. But the effects of the destruction of bourgeois society in Eastern Europe were scarcely enticing, and the truth about the Cultural Revolution in China became too apparent to be any longer deniable, to say nothing of Kampuchea. The rise of libertarianism as an alternative is not at all surprising. Many of the new libertarians were once socialists. They have exchanged one faith for another. It was the revival of libertarianism which stimulated me into giving these lectures. But I always have in mind, too, the state socialist alternative. We may well be tempted to revert to it if the Thatcher, Fraser, Reagan policies are finally rejected by the electorate. A contingency made the more probable by the fact that they have adopted, under the influence of Milton Friedman, one particular form of government intervention, monetarism, an economic nostrum which sounds so simple to implement that its popularity with politicians is fully understandable. But perhaps the truth of the matter is that we ought to commit ourselves neither to a full-blown libertarianism nor to a full-blown state socialism, but nevertheless should move from our present position in one or the other direction. Before we decide in which direction we wish to move, however, we should certainly ask ourselves where government meets its limits, what it cannot do at all or cannot do well, and on the other side, what only it can do well. Otherwise, we may wake up to find that we have destroyed what we wanted to retain, have weakened what we wanted to strengthen, have strengthened what we hoped to destroy. To use a razor to shave is one thing, to use it to cut arteries, quite another. These explanations over, let us return to our main theme. To begin with a fundamental question, are governments as impotent in the face of social laws as they are in the face of natural laws? There are two sorts of laws, or supposed laws, to be taken into account. Those laws which purport to describe the inevitable course of human history, on the one hand, and on the other hand, more modest laws which purport to relate specific kinds of social occurrence, asserting that a government cannot do this or that without bringing about such and such specific consequences. Marxism is the most familiar example, although by no means the only example, of the attempt to establish historical laws. One cannot nowadays assert that Marx taught this or that without bringing a storm of protest about one's head. there are as many varieties of Marxism as there are of Christianity, each purporting to tell us what their founder really said and really meant. But at least according to fundamentalist Marxism, every government is limited by its incapacity to hold back, except temporarily, the inevitable movement of history towards communism. Any bourgeois government which attempts to prevent once and for all a proletarian revolution is as doomed to failure as Canute would have been had he really tried to prevent the flow of the tides. Nor can such a government help acting in a way which will in the long run facilitate the communist revolution. To ask, as I did, in what direction we wish to move is on this view entirely pointless. We shall be driven into communism, whatever we wish, whatever we decide. We may be totally unconvinced, I certainly am totally unconvinced, by the broad sweep of Marxist prophecy, which for a time replaced the apocalyptic book of Daniel as the favourite reading of intellectuals. But Marx was an acute observer of social trends, and he might still be right in believing that the bourgeoisie have dug their own grave, and that it is too late for any government, simply by withdrawing from intervention, to prevent them from falling into it. The Thatcher government originally assumed that private enterprise was impatiently waiting on the sidelines to take over, that all the government needed to do was to control the money supply and to reduce public expenditure, that private enterprise would immediately move into the gap thus created. But what did the Federation of British Industry demand? First, that the government should embark on large-scale construction enterprises in order to give work to the construction industries. Secondly, that it should set aside vast sums of money to help new industries to get going. Business has got so used to large government expenditures, to government subsidies, open or concealed, that it can scarcely imagine surviving without them. Analysts of American business complain, indeed, that a new managerial class has taken over the reins, a class made up of lawyers and financial experts who are splendidly equipped for boardroom manoeuvres but are totally ignorant of the daily life of the enterprises which they govern and are only too happy to welcome government intervention, as Chrysler did, whenever it enables them to continue doing what they have been doing with less risk of competition. German critics of Germany's recent industrial development make a similar point. Entrepreneurs, they say, have been driven out by lawyers and administrators, partly, no doubt, in the attempt to find some way around the growing volume of government regulations. As for Australia, the government has found to its chagrin that the private sector demands subsidies, guarantees, tariff protection, preferential power rates, public works, before it will even contemplate setting up new enterprises. The government, it would seem, has at the back of its mind a picture of the capitalist free market which no longer bears any relation to reality. If this is so, however, it is not because some vast historical process is at work which guarantees the victory of communism, but as a result of the working of the second of the two sorts of laws I earlier distinguished, laws which link social phenomena to one another in a particular social situation. Of so much I feel confident. It is another matter, however, to nominate the laws. There are certainly a number of commonplace general social principles which can be enunciated with some confidence, even if it would be somewhat pretentious to dignify them with the name of law. I have in mind such principles as you can't please everybody, you can't fool all the people all the time, every important action has unexpected consequences, you can't do only one thing at a time. Such principles already limit government action. They rule out, for example, the possibility of total planning if that rests on the presumption that a government is ever in a position to know precisely what the total effects of its interventions will be. what Adam Smith said is still true. No human wisdom or knowledge, he wrote, could ever be sufficient to govern satisfactorily the entire economic life of the community. When it comes to laws of a more scientific sort, making possible precise predictions, as such commonplace principles do not, the situation is distinctly more obscure. A government is told by some recognized experts, the sort of people who it thinks ought to know, that it can control inflation only by decreasing demand, or only by increasing supply, or only by controlling the money supply. It does not know which of these views is correct. It may also not know how to act, even on the assumption that a particular theory is correct. It may find, for example, that it cannot control the money supply except by acting in ways which cut across its other policies. For example, by raising interest rates to a point which is a deterrent to home ownership or to new industrial initiatives, or by refusing entry to overseas capital. Perhaps someday this ignorance will be partly remedied. But given the great complexity of society, it will never be remedied to a degree which makes the centralized planning of the economy a preferable alternative from the standpoint of economic efficiency to day-to-day adjustments in the marketplace in response to information which flows through the price system. On that point, I believe, the libertarians are clearly right. Whether their wider onslaught on government follows from that premise is quite another matter. We may be prepared to accept government intervention, even at some economic cost, for reasons which seem to us sufficient. To explore that possibility, I shall in the next three lectures look in turn at each of the three major forms of government intervention: coercion, protection, subsidization. And then in the last lecture, I shall ask more particularly how our discussions bear on the Australian scene. By the nature of the case, this will have to be something of a Cook's tour, at times superficial, dogmatic, moving too rapidly for ready absorption, but detailed enough, I hope, to provoke discussion on fundamental issues. Given the complexity of the topic, its range, and my own ignorance, the most I can expect is to awaken a little discussion. These lectures are not the last word on the limits of government. They are scarcely even the first word. There are two sorts of terrorists, nationalistic terrorists and anarchistic terrorists. The nationalistic terrorist has no hostility to government as such. He uses terror in the hope of forcing a particular government to renounce its claim to be the legitimate government in a particular region. So the Basque terrorists deny that the Spanish government is the legitimate ruler over Basque territories, the IRA terrorists that the British government is the legitimate ruler of Northern Ireland. In contrast, the anarchistic terrorists are hostile to government itself, just because it is coercive. They agree with Tom Paine that government is evil, but refuse to admit that, as he argued, it is a necessary evil, that society cannot keep going without a degree of coercion, of institutionalized violence. Then how do they justify their own use of force? For the majority of respectable citizens in a democratic society, the government is a protective rather than a coercive agent. In other words, the anarchist terrorist would say, a democratic government hides its iron fist in a velvet glove. Even when it commands good, wrote the anarchist Bakunin, it makes this valueless by commanding it, for every command slaps liberty in the face. The objective of the anarchist terrorist is to tear off the velvet glove. He uses violence in order to force government into counter-violence. As the counter-violence intensifies, the citizens, so the anarchist hopefully concludes, will come to see government in its true nature as a coercive force, will rise up against it and destroy it. One does not have to share the anarchist's utopianism to see what he has in mind. The libertarian, with his enthusiasm for small government, partly agrees with the anarchist. A government, they both point out, can offer us what, for example, it calls free schooling and should more properly call tax-paid schooling only by coercing citizens into paying taxes. Furthermore, it surrounds its free schooling by coercive conditions. It makes schooling up to a certain age compulsory. It coerces the child who plays truant or the parent who keeps a child away from school. It compels the child to attend a certain school or a certain type of school. It may coerce teachers who depart from a fixed syllabus or who refuse to go to a school to which they are sent. It does not permit those it benefits to act with the total spontaneity of a voluntary agent. A second truth, which the anarchist particularly emphasizes, is that a government, especially a democratic government, will usually seek to minimize the use of force. It purports to govern with the consent of the people. The overt use of force, except against individual criminals or minorities who are strongly condemned by public opinion, threatens its legitimacy. It tries, rather, to conciliate. That is the velvet glove the anarchist detests. That is why terrorism sets for liberal democracy so terrible a dilemma. It may see no way of dealing with terrorism except by departing from its own principles precisely in the manner the terrorist desires, by coercing openly and brutally. In the present lecture, my emphasis will be on the iron fist, on how far coercion can carry a government, to what degree its powers of coercion are limited. In later lectures, I shall talk about protection and subsidization, the velvet glove. I began with the anarchist because he, and many libertarians after him, so strongly emphasizes the central importance to government of coercion. But much of my argument is directed not against the anarchist, not against the libertarian, but rather against those who are constantly calling upon the government to coerce, to exercise a greater degree of control. Coercion, so much is clear, can carry a government a long way when it is not subject to democratic constraints. Stalin was a grim reminder of that fact. Of course, coercion is subject to those obvious limits we have already enunciated. It can break down the resistance of individuals, but it cannot destroy natural or social laws or dispel ignorance about their nature. By invasion or the threat of invasion, a government can sometimes enlarge its resources, but it cannot create them. A government is further limited by the fact that it wants to stay in power. To keep in power, it has to do two things: to retain the support of those groups in the community which form its power base, which supply its funds, which will swing their authority behind it, and to conciliate such of its opponents as it cannot coerce into submission or buy off or persuade to change their views. It cannot, without losing their support, coerce its supporters. It may not, in practice, be able to coerce its opponents. There is a familiar view about governments which one still sometimes hears expressed, but which will not stand investigation. That is, that government is the sole repository of power in the community, possessing absolute sovereignty. Totalitarian governments try to make that view true by destroying every other institution in the society, every alternative source of power, so that absolutely nothing, no organization of any sort, stands between the government and the individual, who can then be coerced whenever the government chooses to do so, with no organisation to come to his rescue. Stalin's Russia came nearer to achieving that objective than Hitler's Germany. But as we shall be suggesting, neither quite succeeded. As for democracies, in any democratic society it will be far from true that all power is concentrated in the hands of the government. It is not true either in traditional authoritarian societies, in which the government does not try to penetrate into every nook and cranny of society. Trotsky got it right when he distinguished between Stalin and the traditional tyrant. Traditional authoritarian rulers had said, like Louis XIV, "I am the state, I am government." But Stalin wanted to say, "I am society." So long as society, the network of quasi-independent organisations, continues in existence, government is not the sole source of power. These organisations exert a kind of power peculiar to them, which governments do not possess and may be unable to destroy. The medieval church is a familiar instance. It had two coercive powers which no government possessed. Spiritually, it was a closed shop. Outside the church, so it taught, there was no salvation. When it excommunicated, there was no other church to join. And then there was the interdict. If a government proved really difficult, the whole community, innocent or guilty, could be refused the sacraments. The church has continued to be powerful. Hitler and Stalin destroyed or sought to destroy minority religious groups, the Russian Baptists, Jews, Jehovah's Witnesses, where they could rely on the tacit approval of the more powerful churches. But no government as yet has been able wholly to destroy any major religious organisation, although it may succeed in emasculating it. The nearest analogy to the medieval church in Australia and Great Britain is the trade union. Theoretically, the Labour Party can count it as a supporter. But watching a newly elected Labour government trying to come to terms with the unions, one is reminded of a passage in Machiavelli's The Prince, describing a parallel situation. He writes thus, "You cannot maintain the friendship of those who have helped you to obtain this possession, as you will not be able to fulfil their expectations, nor can you use strong measures against them, being under an obligation to them." No Australian government, whatever its political complexion, has total control over the unions. Unions, like the medieval church, have established closed shops, although their earlier ambitions to establish a single all-encompassing union, which would have made the parallel more exact, came to nothing. The strike is the modern equivalent of the medieval interdict, the scab of the heretic. The refusal to work with scabs is the equivalent of excommunication. Like the medieval church, too, unions can exercise their power across national borders. Although one is not burnt at the stake for doing so, to talk unfavourably of union power is to invite condemnation for union bashing or an accusation of disturbing the social order by seeking confrontations, as if union power was somehow sacrosanct and every strike were not, of its very nature, a confrontation, a rejection of conciliation, of compromise. A totalitarian government, of course, will do to unions what authoritarian governments finally did in so many countries to the church. It will permit unions only as organs of government. No government which aspires wholly to direct the economic life of the community can possibly grant to unions those powers they now possess which make them capable of disrupting any economic plan. Neither can a libertarian government. Libertarians are perfectly willing for individuals to join together to seek to improve their conditions
or to get higher salaries. But they would certainly not permit compulsory unionism. They would not allow unions to prevent non-unionists entering into free contracts with employers or accepting employment in an organisation where the employees are on strike. And by prohibiting such actions, a libertarian government would take away from unions precisely those powers which make them analogous to the medieval church. The real problem is whether any in-between government, neither strictly state socialist nor strictly libertarian, of the sort we have in Australia, can permit unions to continue to exert the degree of power they now have without losing its capacity to intervene effectively in the economic life of the community. Some union leaders, of course, are following Lenin's advice to use every stratagem to get control over unions as a means of destroying democracy and, in the long run, union power itself. But if the use of union power finally destroys democracy, it will not, I think, be as a result of the efforts of relatively few and divided communists. It will be an unintended consequence of the very natural attempt of thousands of unionists to improve or maintain their position in relation to other workers. This is especially so now that middle-class employees have discovered the strike weapon as a means of making the well-off better off still. Not the radicalism, but the conservatism of unionists may finally destroy our society by refusing to permit that closing down of uneconomic industries which both our situation in the world and our internal economy demands, by refusing to accept any changes in relative incomes or in industrial practices, by opposing technical innovation. Unions are essential to a society which succumbs neither to libertarian nor to state socialist ideology. They protect workers against coercion, whether by employees or government. Yet by a dreadful paradox, unions may help to destroy the only economy in which they can survive. They may open the way for an authoritarian takeover by turning the strike into a first instead of a last recourse, by trivialising it, by making it a weapon in inter-union battles. Large corporations, especially of the multinational sort, are another familiar instance of power-controlling institutions. The power they can exercise derives from their control on a major scale over money, resources, employment, and their capacity to shift their resources from country to country. They can force governments to intervene when they do not wish to intervene, and not to intervene when they wish to intervene. 1,000 motels all over the country could put off one employee each and simultaneously reduce their demands on a multitude of suppliers without anybody noticing. For a large factory to close down, even when it throws a considerably smaller number of persons out of work, is regarded as a national calamity. As it can threaten to do so if a government tries to use coercion against it or refuses to accede to its demands, demands which are often, as in the case of tariffs, also backed by the force of unions. The libertarian would reduce the power of corporations by calling upon governments to abolish all tariffs, to abandon all subsidies, to refrain from sweetheart deals between governments and corporations, to ensure that the legal system favours competition. But if it attempts to do these things, just as if it tries to use legal sanctions against unions, a government may at once alienate its supporters and arouse unmanageable hostility amongst its opponents, social consequences about which the libertarian economist is strangely silent. What governments can in principle do may greatly differ from what a particular government can in fact do. The media, with their control over communications, the farmers with their control over agricultural production, are other obvious instances of social organisations which can lend powerful support to governments they favour and create powerful opposition to governments to which they are hostile. The media have been discussed to the point of boredom, farmers much less. but their power is equally apparent whether the farmers are Southeast Asian poppy growers, German hobby farmers, French peasants, East European agriculturalists, Montana wool growers, or Australian squatters. Many of the most apparently absurd features of the world economic system derive directly from the exercise of farmer force, often concentrated in political special interest groups which hold the balance of power in democratic governments. They tend to display, anywhere and everywhere, the same marked political characteristics: a deep and very understandable devotion to their way of life, a profound mistrust of cities and city activities as parasitic growths, a firm belief that only what comes from the land is truly valuable, and that they, therefore, perhaps along with miners, are peculiarly worthy of support. Both their economic power as food growers and their firm convictions of their own superior worth have presented a problem to many a government intent on coercing them, as the failure of Soviet agricultural policy has made particularly apparent. One could continue this list for a long time. Universities have in many countries proved difficult to coerce. In Spain, to take a case, the church, the army, the university have traditionally been the three institutions which have most endangered governments which have attempted to coerce them. I just mentioned the army as a potential opponent. This may seem more than a little odd, since the army is a governmental coercive instrumentality. But this is one great limitation on the power of government. It has to work through institutions or persons which it cannot avoid making powerful, but which may then turn that power against it. Roman emperors were often overthrown by that very praetorian guard which had the function of protecting them. A widely reported attack on the Spanish Cortes by this civil guard reminds us that something very similar can still happen. So the coercive power of government is a double-edged weapon. Government may have no way of coercing the instruments through which it exercises coercion. And indeed, instruments is a misleading word. A government has to work through organizations with their own traditions, their own interests to maintain. Another notable instance is what we call the public service, but is more accurately described as the government service. After all, we, members of the public, cannot dismiss its members as we could a servant, and they regard it as part of their function to tell governments what they are not at all prepared to tell us. There is no doubt, servant though it officially is, that the permanent administration can powerfully resist the operations of any particular executive of which it disapproves, if only by dragging its feet. When the ministers of the Whitlam government sought to surround themselves with friends and relatives, or ex-President Carter by fellow Georgians, this was not out of simple nepotism. They mistrusted the civil service. They did not believe that it would carry out their policies. Mr. Herford, the Labour politician, has recently suggested that when a government changes, all first and second level civil servants should resign. This reversion to the old spoils system — one never knows nowadays which party will urge us to revert to the ways of the past — would, on the face of it, strengthen the powers of the government of the day, making it plain that government servants were its servants, whereas our present tenure system makes it appear that they are servants rather of the system of government, with the primary duty of reminding ministers of their responsibility under that system and keeping it going in an efficient manner. Yet many libertarians would agree with Mr. Herford on the very different ground that the spoil system would weaken the power of government while diminishing its expertise. A typical dilemma, in fact, arises. If a government strengthens the powers of those who are supposed to be its servants, whether the army or the bureaucracy, it may exercise its power over the community more effectively, but only at the risk that its instruments will turn against it. If it weakens the power of its servants, it may simultaneously weaken its own power to act. So much for the fact that governments may be limited by the presence in society of hostile institutions and the need to retain the support of their friends. Now to turn to a much more general issue. Is it true, as is often asserted, that although governments can alter the overt behaviour of human beings by coercion, they cannot affect their inner life? It would be very nice to believe this. The totalitarian state could then never achieve its ends, its final purpose of constructing a society in which everybody thinks and feels as one. By the use of terror, on this view, it can make its citizens conform in their behaviour, but inwardly they are untouched. But in fact, this distinction between private thoughts and public behaviour will not bear the weight that is put upon it. Suppose a person is living in a country where the government uses its powers of coercion to prohibit the entrance of what it calls hostile literature, makes it an offence to say anything which is opposed to the official doctrines, has at its disposal a network of informers, prohibits foreign travel, totally controls the media. There will still no doubt be dissenters, but their number is likely to be very small indeed. Coercion under such circumstances can greatly influence not only how people act, but how they think and feel. The philosopher Kolakowski, now of Oxford, formerly a resistance leader in Poland, has put the point well. People, he writes, in constant fear of saying something that might land them in trouble, simply do not, after a time, even think the sorts of things that might boomerang on them. In such circumstances, however, where feelings, thoughts are repressed, there is always a danger that they will break out in a sudden explosion. That is why totalitarian societies place such stress on education, understood as meaning indoctrination, in which the child or even the adult is conditioned into having the right beliefs, the right feelings, the right thoughts, and on censorship to prevent its citizens from having access to heretical feelings, heretical thoughts. The object is to ensure that they will not need to repress dangerous thoughts. They will simply not have such thoughts. They will not come into their mind. Coercion by itself, as I keep on saying, is a double-edged weapon, but that is by no means to say that it is wholly ineffective. There are, however, important forms of feeling, ways of thinking, which no one can be coerced into. It is impossible, in particular, to force anyone to be imaginative, to be free, to be affectionate. And that is a fact of very great importance. Imagination lies at the heart of all culture, in the broadest possible sense of that word. Not merely at the heart of literature and the arts, as would generally be admitted, but at the heart of science, of philosophy, of technology, of industry, whenever it is something more than the routine application of already known principles. Sure enough, one can in various ways encourage people to develop these qualities. To some degree, even the Soviet Union has had to do so. But the imaginative are the bane of its existence, the major source of dissent. Only in a free society can imagination have full reign. As for the view that one can be forced to be free, that is George Orwell's newspeak, double talk at its very worst. Let me sum up. A government which tries to meet all its objectives by coercion will inevitably run up against limits, not only in the form of opposition within its own society, but because there is much that cannot be achieved by this means. That is one of the libertarian's main points. But even the totalitarian recognizes as much and tries to achieve his ends by other means, by, for example, controlling the education system. There is much, too, that a particular government cannot achieve by coercion without changing its character. That fact presents a special problem for democracy whenever, as in its dealings with terrorists or strikers or religious fanatics, its chosen methods of conciliation break down. It may be transformed in spite of itself, into an authoritarian state out of sheer desperation. And don't say it can't happen here. It can.